The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So tonight, I want to talk to you about wise speech. This is a very important skill to develop, and it's a central topic in Buddhism. When I was a child, I remember my father telling me, remember that words can be more hurtful than a blow. And with time, I've learned to realize that it's so true. Words have tremendous power. And converting thoughts to words happens so fast and easily that before we know, we have said something that's untimely, false, harsh, or destructive. It is quite difficult to consistently apply mindfulness to speech, but it is also of great benefit when we do. Now, wise speech is the third step in the Noble Eightfold Path. This path is a wonderful aid that the Buddha offered us, and it functions as a guide. The Buddha realized how difficult it was for human beings to find lasting happiness, and so he pointed to the cultivation of the following eight areas: wise view, wise intention, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, wise diligence, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration. So we're doing number three of these eight steps today. This path, when followed diligently, leads to the liberation from suffering. So as you see, the Buddha devoted a specific area of study for the topic of wise speech because it is so central for our personal and spiritual development. Some of you already know that we have a lot of lists in Buddhism. So we also have a list for the qualities that we want to develop for wise speech. In the middle-length discourses, the Buddha offered these five qualities that we need to investigate to practice wise speech. So we want to train ourselves to use language that is timely, that is gentle, that is helpful, and emanating from a mind state of loving kindness. Now, this means that before we speak, we keep in mind the following questions. What I am about to say, is it timely? Is it true? Is it gentle? Is it helpful? Is it emanating from a mind of loving kindness? If what we are about to say does not have one or more of these qualities, then we are asked to remain silent. Wise speech does not only imply skillful speaking, but also skillful listening. The quality of how we listen is of great importance. If we listen with a clear, open, and equanimous mind, the speaker will feel truly seen and heard. I've heard Gil say a couple times that the person who does the listening does the loving. So wise speech requires from us a dual attention, that is, awareness of our body, of our feelings, of our thoughts, as well as awareness of what the other person is communicating through words and also nonverbal cues that might communicate emotions. Our speech is the messenger of our thoughts. So it is of great import to pay attention to the quality of our thoughts. If we spend long periods of time with thoughts that are full of greed, ill will, or envy, this will, of course, influence our speech, our mood, and even our health. But the opposite is also true. If we cultivate a mind full of loving kindness, of generosity, of compassion, then our language will reflect these qualities. So let us now investigate the five qualities that the Buddha offers to cultivate wise speech. I'll take one at a time. The first one is it timely? I think we've all been in situations where we've spoken, and then we have this sinking feeling of, oh dear, this was totally inappropriate and timely. Depending how much we have practiced our mindfulness, we will be able first to recognize if a particular moment is opportune. Second, resist the desire to speak if we notice that it is not timely. And third, recognize the moment when our words can be beneficial. I want to share with you an example that illustrates these three steps very well. The peace scholar Michael Nagler describes in his book, The Search for a Nonviolent Future, how on one occasion he and his wife were invited to a very formal dinner. It was at the house of a French baron in Paris. The baroness presented Nagler and his wife with an exquisite dinner, and as they were eating, he commented, "Oh, I completely believe in racial inequality." Nagler's wife blanched, knowing that her husband was likely to make a scene. Nagler, however, had already about a year experience of meditation under his belt, and he caught himself, and he did not respond because he noticed that that was not the right moment. He held his tongue. A few minutes later, talking on another topic, the baron said, "You know, nothing in the world matters but love." To this, Nagler responded quietly, "Do you think the races are unequally endowed with the capacity to love?" The baron was stunned. Nagler's elegant comeback reflected his ability to apply mindfulness to a particular moment, recognizing how to say something constructive at the appropriate time. Nagler writes that he probably did more to reduce the racist burden of the world that evening than he had in a lifetime of activism. The second quality is truth. Truth to me is like a sharp knife. It can be tremendously useful when used at an appropriate time and in the correct manner. It can help us cut away what is false, but it can also be very harmful if spoken in an unskillful way. So when we are about to speak the truth, it is of great importance to ask first, what is our intention? Is it to harm in any way another being, or is it for their benefit? A few years ago, my mother was dying of cancer. She was in Mexico, and unfortunately, many doctors still believe in Mexico that patients should be spared the truth. To her probing questions, she would get simplistic answers from her oncologist as if she were a child. This was extremely difficult for me to witness, especially after the doctor communicated to me that my mother had 1 month to live. After considerable soul searching, I decided that I would tell my mother the truth. It was a very, very difficult decision, especially since some family members disapproved of my decision because they were afraid, and understandably so, that my mother's mood would suffer greatly upon hearing the truth. When I took this decision alone, I knew that there was no perfect option that would make everyone happy. So I opted for what seemed to me the most pressing issue at hand, offering the truth in order for my mother to prepare to die. Yes, it was difficult for her at first, but in a matter of hours, the power of the truth seemed to offer her a new strength that led her to make a few crucial and meaningful decisions that in the end allowed her to die peacefully. I was with her when she died, and she was very peaceful. And now we're going to go to the third quality. Is it gentle? Is the speech gentle? From the five qualities, this one, I see being focused on the quality of the speech itself, independent on the outer circumstances. That is, for speech to be timely, true, and helpful, it requires assessing wisely the outer situations at the precise moment. Yet gentle speech implies the way we use the language. From a grosser level or basic level, we start by avoiding harsh language. It is said that it takes years to cultivate a friendship, but seconds to destroy it when using harsh language. Bhante Gunaratana says that rude and harsh language functions like a boomerang. It comes back and hits us when we least expect it. So harsh language not only harms others, but it also debases us. On a more subtle level, if we want to cultivate gentle speech, we need to learn to be aware of our tone of voice. Researchers have proven through various experiments that the tone of voice has a much bigger emotional impact on us than the content of the words. I like to think the way our pets respond to us. For example, dogs. They are extremely sensitive to the tone of voice, but not of the content of our words, with the exception of a handful, maybe, of terms that they learned in dog school. Some years ago, I met a Buddhist nun that had the most gentle and caring tone of voice. When I heard her say the phrases of metta, or loving kindness, my heart melted. To this day, when I need to connect with that sense of loving kindness, I try to bring her voice, to my mind. A close second in importance to tone of voice in the cultivation of gentle speech is the speed we speak with. I think most of us associate a gentle, caring conversation with an unhurried mode of talking. This not only offers calm to the speaker and the listener, but speaking slowly allows us to pay attention to the choice of our words. And thereby, we're less likely to hurt somebody with our words. And now to the fourth quality. Is it helpful? A few days ago, I listened to a very interesting podcast on the effects of how we tell, on the effect of our own storytelling. It is very useful to ask ourselves, when we recount our life stories, how do we portray ourselves and our experiences? Do we cast ourselves in the role of the victim? Do we judge harshly our family members, our friends, our acquaintances? Research shows that people who tell stories full of criticism and in which they cast themselves as victims have a great propensity to depression. Every time we tell our story with the destructive interpretations, it is as if we were digging a deeper groove in a muddy road, so that when we travel on that road again, the wheel will fall easily into that groove again. They also have discovered that our stories are not exact at all, because we seem to shape our stories every time we retell our stories according to the person we want to be. Now, mindfulness invites us to recognize the valuable opportunity we have every time we are about to tell our stories. We have an option to make the groove of suffering deeper that keeps us prisoners of our pain, or we can step back and gain some perspective so that we gradually develop a wise view that liberates us more and more from the attachment to our suffering. Now, let us clarify here that we're not trying to put a Pollyannish twist on our speech and say that everything is nice and that we don't need to face what is. Rather, we attempt to bring a little more perspective each time, a little more loving kindness, a little more compassion for our own weaknesses and that of others. Each time we have the opportunity to recount our life stories, to let go of these unhelpful narratives is like getting rid of some unnecessary burden. With every skillful narration of our life stories, we can lighten up our load a few pounds off our back for our walk on the Noble Eightfold Path. It is also very interesting to notice that depending on who listens to us and how they listen to us, it will have a great influence on how skillfully we tell the story and how much we purify our speech. This is why in the Buddhist teachings we are urged to cultivate wise friends. While I was at Stanford, I met a PhD candidate who was a very brilliant and quiet fellow. As I got to know him, I discovered that he never spoke harshly of anybody. And gossip was just not part of his mode of communication. He rented a room from a woman that was famous for being difficult among students. And yet I never heard him say the least criticism about her or anybody else. Gradually, I realized what a gift this was, because I knew I could trust him. I knew that he wouldn't turn around and speak badly of me. Have you been in a situation where somebody's talking badly about somebody who's not present, and the thought pops into your mind, I wonder what he or she says when I am not present? If we practice discreet and skillful language, there's a much greater possibility that others will not speak badly of us. After my first long residential retreat many years ago, I discovered for the first time how so much of our speech is utterly unnecessary and how much of our energy we spend talking. How often do we speak because we are afraid of silence? Once I began applying mindfulness to speech, I noticed how sad it is. People who are lonely and have this mode of communication where they will speak incessantly, it doesn't matter what, as long as they can continue talking. This is extremely sad because this is not only not satisfying for anybody, but it leaves the person who's alone even more alone, or in other words, they don't get what they most need, which is the connection. So I am a big believer in making pauses. Pauses in which we can connect with the awareness of our body, our emotions, our thoughts, but also the awareness of the other person. It has been scientifically proven that people who have practiced mindfulness diligently for many years are capable of reading many, many more face gestures in other people in a matter of 1 or 2 seconds. So are we really able to see and listen to the person with whom we are speaking? With our mindfulness, we can detect when a conversation turns idle. Idle chatter, and we are able to pay attention how we feel when we are exposed to such vacuous talk. For me, it has a very palpable physical feeling. It feels as if I had eaten some junk food. And it also, there's a sense of disappointment of the time lost. However, the opposite is also true. If I am part of a conversation that is wise and gentle, then afterwards I feel profoundly nourished and peaceful. The last quality that the Buddha offers for wise speech is that of the language that emanates for a mind state of loving kindness. 3 of the previous qualities deal with something outside ourselves, that is it timely, true, and helpful? These are things that we have to observe outside ourselves. 1 I mentioned before deals with the quality of our speech, that is, if speech is gentle. But for the last quality, we are asked to look inward and investigate our mind state. Are we speaking from a mind state of loving kindness? a very important piece in the cultivation of loving kindness is the awareness of the quality of our inner voice. This is related to our thinking. Have we become conscious of how we speak to ourselves? If we speak to ourselves in a timely, true, gentle, helpful way and emanating from a state of loving kindness, then we will speak in that manner to others. It is therefore essential that we understand the interconnectedness of thoughts, speech, and action. To finish, I want to read to you a quote from the Dhammapada, where the Buddha, in a very, very beautiful way, presents this interconnection of thought, speech, and action. All that we are is the result of what we have thought. It is founded on our thoughts. It is made up of our thoughts. If a man speaks or acts with an evil thought, pain follows him, as the wheel follows the foot of the ox that draws the carriage. All that we are is the result of what we have thought. It is founded on our thoughts. It is made up of our thoughts. If a man speaks or acts with a pure thought, happiness follows him like a shadow that never leaves him. So thank you. And we have time for questions, so...
Thank you. That was so exquisite. There are so many things you mentioned that I could almost spend an hour just asking questions. But I was wondering if you could repeat one thing or paraphrase mm-hmm. it. The one about the way you tell a story adds to depression or causes it. I just missed a couple
sure.
of words that preceded that.
So what I would like to first stress is that every time we find ourselves in a situation where we can tell our story, that we look at it as a golden opportunity. That is, we're not going to repeat it the same way. It doesn't help anybody. What we want to do is, can we tell the story in a way that will help us free ourselves a little bit more from the suffering that holds us in the story? So in this study that they did, they found that people who consistently tell a story where they portray themselves as a victim and they judge mercilessly right and left, these people tend to have an enormous propensity to depression.
If I could just say one other thing, mm-hmm. I was really keying in on what you're saying about people who perhaps are lonely and will talk incessantly. Mm-hmm. And it seems like the last few months, there's different people I'll try to engage in conversation. And I'll start off and then they'll just cut me off and then they make it all about them and it's no longer dialogue, it's this monologue that has no
yeah.
ending.
Yeah.
There's no pauses and I'm caught in this thing of, well, how do I get out of this? Because this is going on now for 25, 30, mm-hmm. 40 minutes, and I try to give body language, or my fail-safe is, I have to go to the bathroom right now, or pretend that my cell phone is vibrating, I've got to take a call, but it's a very awkward thing. Am I damaging the individual by saying, I've got to go, or
yes.
whatever? But I've just noticed
yes.
I'm meeting more and more people that just keep talking and talking to me. So... just an observation.
Yes, I think that's very common, and of course, a monologue. What ends up in a conversation ends up communicating for the other person that you're not really perceiving them, that you're so fascinated by your own ideas that you're just going on and on. You know, depending on who one is talking to, we could have different responses, but if it's somebody that you want to engage with, you might want to consider asking, how do you feel? Just kind of, many times these monologues arise from anxiety, from tremendous sadness or loneliness, as I mentioned. So it would be wonderful if that person can stop and become aware of how they're feeling. Now, if you really want to make a connection and you think the person can take it, you can ask them, how does your body feel?
Well, that would be going out on a limb. It sounds like it's worth trying.
Yes, especially if it's somebody you want to connect with. You know, if you see potential there and you want to explore.
Great. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I just have a couple of comments. Well, one, a comment and a question. When you were just now speaking about telling stories where it's about the person, they try to make themselves look good and critique.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, but this, it just sounded like you were talking directly about that sheriff in San Francisco that has got himself in so much trouble. I mean, I don't know if you heard his recent statements, but that's what he's been doing. My other question is, if you speak from a place of loving kindness, don't the other criteria take care of themselves?
That's an excellent question. And I actually had that conversation with the Buddhist nun that I live with. I live in a little community. And that was my initial sense. And as I investigated a little bit with her, she said, no, I think that the timely aspect or the help, that I think the helpful, yes, I think that would be a natural. The timely, not necessarily, might or might not. So it depends. But I think that it's telling that the Buddha presented it as this list of five. So, I mean, one could say, and that was my original thought, he presented it at the end because within this last one, the previous four are subsumed. And I think in certain cases might be true, but the benefit of having this list is that it makes you think about wise speech from all these different perspectives. It makes you consider the ways that we need to train ourselves. So I don't think it hurts to spell it out and say, yes, we need to ask ourselves, is it timely? Is it gentle? Is it helpful? Etc. So it might not, but it's helpful to have the variety, the list.
It also seems to me that that's the easiest place to become delusional, to say what I'm doing is kindly and gently telling somebody what they need to know when it isn't really helpful. And to check back on the other points and say, is it timely and is it helpful, also brings you back to reality a little bit.
Mm-hmm. So are you saying that in the state of loving kindness that would be is that what you meant, that would be the state that you would be more easily deluded?
Yeah, uh-huh. And that it's easier to say, well, it's okay to say that because I'm saying it from a place of loving of love and kindness, but it might not be helpful and it might not be timely.
Yes. Well, you know, the thing about a state of loving kindness or a state of quietude or of patience, it's something that we learn in stages. So the more you practice, the more you realize, oh, so this is the way it feels when you're imbued with loving kindness. So it, you will have a sense of reality of what it is according to where you are in the path. And so I guess that's why I would say to your question, that's another reason why we want to have these other more practical tools, you know, that make you look outside yourself. Okay, this person is doing this, that person is saying that, so is this timely? So like the example with Michael Nagler, I mean, he was able to sense, here we are, this baroness has made this wonderful dinner for us. Is this the right time to get into a heated discussion about race? No, it wasn't. And he realized that. So, did it answer your question? It kind of went off a little bit on the side. Yes?
Yeah, no, it did.
Okay. And I really appreciate your questions, because otherwise, you know, giving this talk does feel like just so one-sided. So I'd love getting to hear from you. You were going to say?
So what do you say to bullies who try to intimidate you or to try to control you?
Well, that's a big, big, big topic. You know, the first thing that comes to mind, if this is a topic that interests you, I would highly recommend Marshall Rosenberg's book, Nonviolent Communication. Because there he gives you very specific tools in a few steps how to deal with that kind of situation. And basically what he says, for this kind of situation, when somebody is judging you, they are feeling a need that has not been met. The same for us. Every time we judge, if we are able to sink in and say, what is it that I am needing right now? Then this judgment really dissolves because you take care of yourself. So basically, Rosenberg says, try to read what are the feelings behind of what the person is saying and listen with empathy. Listen until the person has finished. You know, suppose somebody says something really rude to you, then you say, instead of getting into a repartee, you say, well, I hear that you are uncomfortable with whatever. And then the person changes a little bit already their mode and starts to tell you what it is, why it is that they are upset about this. And little by little, the mode of verbal sparring changes into a communication that constructs where you are supporting each other, where you're really listening. So of course I can't really give you, you know, Rosenberg's book in one little bit, but I do recommend it. It's an excellent, excellent book. Does that help? I can see from your face that there's something that's
yeah, I've been told that I should do like make eye message and things like that. But I do think bullies are not the same as normal people who feel upset sometimes.
Can you be more specific?
They probably have a need, but they come across, you know, they want you to feel that you're inferior to mm-hmm. them. Oh, they want to control you. They want you to do things what they want you to do. And usually there's a pattern. They have been doing the same thing over and over and again.
Yeah, so the question would be...
I'm not sure. You know, I understand when you have a conflict with other people, mm-hmm. having, you know, some kind of iMessage being good. But I'm not sure dealing with certain people who want to feel that they have control, you know, it's a really good idea to be empathetic toward them.
You know, it really, it's a very good question, and it really depends to what, how primitive of a situation are we dealing with. I mean, are we talking, the most primitive level is, are we talking about the huge, hulky bully that's going to harm you physically? I mean, in that kind of situation, we're talking a different. This is another level. There you look for a way to protect yourself. There you remove yourself. That's a very different situation.
So you think the traditional method is that you stand out to the bullies, and you know, sometimes it's you bully back to them, or you fight back. So that is not a good response.
So now we're talking about a verbal exchange?
Yeah, I think when you get adult bullies really get physical.
Okay, so yeah, the physical I think we can leave to one side, right? So the physical, we have to be very practical. Some of us who are small, we're not going to, you know, and we don't want to go there. You just look for safety. But in a verbal exchange, you know, there is so much the idea in our society that anger empowers us, that if we just can only get angry back with somebody, then we're really going to be able to feel strong. And it is true, anger does give you a sense of energy. But I like very much the simile that is given in the Buddhist teachings, that allowing yourself to be upset or angry about somebody is as if you took with your bare hand some burning coals and then throw it to somebody. Who gets burned first? You do, right? So, if I may bring back Marshall Rosenberg, what Marshall Rosenberg says is, take responsibility for your own feelings. What other people do to you is not the cause, is the stimulus. You decide. It's up to you if you're going to be angry or not. There is a choice, and mindfulness will teach you along the way, that there is a choice at some point. So it's a very big topic, and a topic that I think we all can learn more. But I think that idea of distinguishing that if somebody's bullying me verbally, that I have a choice to bite the hook and dangle in pain, or to turn around things and do a judo move. So I take the blow and turn around and do something else with it, and not necessarily aggressive.
Does it take a lot of practice in order to do that?
A lot of practice. A lot of practice. So what I would recommend to you is read the book and get together with a group of people who are interested and practice it. Because it's very interesting how, when our emotions get in the way, how our mind gets clouded. a while ago, not that long ago, I was in a meeting and I had to give my honest opinion about somebody. And I had some misgivings about somebody. And I just sat there and froze for a minute and said, how do I do it without judging? You want to say the truth, right? But you don't want to judge. So the wonderful thing that we learn is that instead of saying, over there is wrong, I say, what it makes me feel is here. So this and this thing makes me feel X, Y, and Z because X, Y, and Z. And that's very different than you are or he is or she is. You see the difference?
I guess I'm thinking about a more extreme situation. So if I practice enough and somebody screamed and yelled at me, will I not feel affected? Will I still be at peace?
You know, I'm glad you brought that up. A conversation, when it gets that out of hand, when somebody is screaming, there's no benefit. When somebody is screaming, I would recommend that you say, I'd love to talk to you, but let's wait till we're both calm. And you remove yourself. A good, simple way to check if you are able to talk in a constructive way is for 3 seconds, close your eyes and check in with your body. Are you in a knot? Is your stomach in a knot? Is your breath very shallow? Are your hands sweating? All of those emotions are read in the body. That's the simplest, clearest way to read emotion. Check in with your body. If your body is tense, your breath is shallow, chances are about 95%, I would say, that the language that's going to come out is going to be unskillful. So wait. You know, you can say, I need to go to the bathroom. If the person is really not willing or constructive, you say, I definitely want to talk to you, but I need to run to the bathroom. And then hang out in the bathroom for a while and do breathing meditation and stretches and whatever it takes to move the energy. You've got to allow your body to undo the knot so that you can then speak from a place of power, but also in a gentle way. Does it make sense now? I hope that's a little useful. Yeah? Okay. So one more.
Is this on? The fourth item on the list that you were talking about, telling the story, now I can't remember how you were...
Is it helpful?
Okay. Mm-hmm. So it's timely, gentle...
Is it timely? Is it true? Is it gentle? Is it helpful? And emanating from a state of loving kindness.
Thank you.
You're welcome. That was a simple, short one. Okay. So it was a short one. So if anybody has another short question. Yes?
I wanted to thank you for a point that you made. You had said that the way you talk to yourself, to apply those same rules. And I would say that I'm pretty guilty of not applying those same rules. There's times where I don't get past the is it true thing, you know, where I'm overreacting to something and I am anticipating something negative happening. And I'll do some sort of proliferation where I'm anticipating something negative, and that's reinforcing something that's untrue. Mm-hmm. And it was nice to be able to have the idea of applying those criteria to myself. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you. I thank you all. It was a pleasure to be here with you. Good night.